This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Stories. Russia says Syria's air defenses shot down 7 out of 8 missiles launched by Israeli warplanes during a Monday airstrike on Aleppo province. South Korea registers a new daily record of infections from the coronavirus as the country grapples with a surge in the Delta variant of the disease. And Turkey dismisses as null and void the European Union's criticism of Ankara for deciding to reopen an abandoned Cypriot resort town. Welcome to the program. Newly revealed data shows Syria's air defenses shot down 7 out of 8 missiles launched by Israeli warplanes during a Monday airstrike on Aleppo province. According to the Russian military, 4 Israeli F-16 fighter jets targeted facilities southeast of Aleppo in the attack. The military said the Syrian anti-air units used Pantsir-S and Buk-M2 systems supplied by Russia. One missile damaged the building of a scientific research center in the As-Safira region. Earlier, a Syrian military official also confirmed the country's air defenses shot down most of the missiles shot in the airstrike. Over the past years, Israel has carried out hundreds of attacks on Syria, leaving civilian casualties at times. Damascus has repeatedly protested to the UN, condemning the attacks as a breach of its sovereignty. Russia has successfully tested a missile defense system, which is to replace its S-400 units. We discussed that story with our guests in our news review program.
Now, the Russian Defense Ministry says that it successfully tested the new S-500 air defense missile systems at a training range in the country's south. In a statement, the ministry said a system was experimented in the Astrakhan region with missiles hitting a high-speed ballistic target. It added the first S-500 system will be deployed to an air and missile defense unit just outside of Moscow once all tests are done. S-500 will replace the S-400 systems. Russia calls it the most advanced anti-missile system in the world. capable of intercepting a whole range of current and future means of air and space attack. It also expected to have a maximum firing range of 600 kilometers. And now joining us for the program is Mr. William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review, joining us from Leesburg, and also Mr. Rustam Safronov, political commentator, joining us out of Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Mr. Safronov, we're going to start with you. The S-300 was a very decent piece of hardware. The S-400 was amazing. So what is the need to upgrade it to the S-500? What kind of threat is Russia faced today where it needs something of this sophistication?
We could see Russia lately in the post-Soviet period trying to not to participate in full-scale arm race with NATO, in trying to work asymmetrically. And because of that, Russian military-industrial complex and Russian militaries trying to use maybe not so much in quantity, but very high quality, sophisticated weapons. For that, Russian science and Russian researchers working very hard to have most advanced technologies to be able, because Russia has to use much less money than West combined to develop their defense systems. So that's why they're trying to have very sophisticated system which wouldn't be possible to penetrate with any potential missile threats. So that's how I would answer your question. So that the development, that competition continues non-stop. So we could see that by different type of armaments and weapons which developed in the last years. Hyper sounds like Zircon, the rockets, and other supersonic rockets. So all of that done just to have some kind of maybe advantage, but without necessity to place weapons in the territory of United States or whatever, try to compete in the amount of the warheads, something like that. That's how I'd explain that phenomenon.
Thank you, Mr. Safronov. And Mr. William Jones out of Leesburg, pleasure to have you back on the program. Mr. Jones, your initial thoughts on this, and if you could also elaborate on that. What kind of threat is Moscow responding to making something this good?
Well, obviously, things have gone from bad to worse in terms of the relationship with the United States, largely because of the policy of the Biden administration to institute a system in which the United States really calls the shots. The United States, that is, has designated Russia as a rival, as well as China. They have also increased the containment issue of Russia by bringing NATO right up to the border of Russia, something that was actually promised that they would not do at the time that the wall came down. But they broke that promise, and they are moving ever closer. There are very provocative things going on. I don't think because people think it's going to lead to war, but they are insistent that they, that is the Western world, the world represented by NATO, by the countries of Europe and the United States, must determine the way the world operates, and that countries outside of that context, outside of the so-called alliance of democracies, where they define both Russia and China, will not have a say in the matter. And this is a threat to Russia. Militarily, the advance of NATO towards Russian soil, as we've seen, provocations in the Black Sea just over the last couple of weeks has created a situation where they feel they're at a threat, and Russia has a commitment that they will defend the fatherland. What the Prometheus anti-missile systems, this S-500, is doing is better to defend the fatherland against possible nuclear war. And also the development of Zircon was an attempt also to maintain a Russian superiority in the case that there will be a war. But the danger is coming from the threat from the West of containing Russia and containing China, and looks like they'd be willing to go to a military conflict to assert their hegemony in the world.
Mr. William Jones from Leesburg, and Mr. Rustam Safronov joining us from Washington, D.C. That's a wrap for this segment of your News of Your program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
South Korea reports a daily record of nearly 1,800 coronavirus cases as the country is grappling with a new surge. The rise is driven by the Delta variant that makes up 40% of the cases. However, mortality rate remains significantly low with an average of 2 daily deaths. One-third of the country's 52 million population has received one dose of a coronavirus vaccine. The government aims to vaccinate 70% by September. Elsewhere in India, the country has added over 42,000 new infections to its COVID-19 total. Some 4,000 more people have also died of the virus over the past 24 hours. India's infection tally stands at over 31 million with an overall death toll of 418,000. Frank Smith earlier told me South Korea has imposed restrictions to bring down the rising number of infections.
As you mentioned, today reached a new high, over 1,700 cases. This has been going on now for about 2 weeks with cases over 1,000 per day. As you mentioned, though, the death rate is quite low, below 2%. So on that score, the government is doing quite well in testing people. So it's quite accurate, I think, the number of people that are infected. Most of these new cases are in the capital. About 2 out of 3 are in the capital region of Seoul. And as you mentioned, the Delta variant is making up a higher and higher percentage of these new cases. And that's particularly worrisome. If you talk to epidemiologists about this, about that Delta variant, it's much more transmissible than the other variants and the initial COVID-19. So there are concerns that, again, daily cases could rise over 2,000. The government is imploring the public to observe the social distancing guidelines that they have put in place. South Korea is one of the countries that hasn't instituted a complete lockdown. You can still go out, but, you know, gatherings more than 2 people after 6 p.m. are banned here in the capital, Seoul. Nightclubs and bars are completely closed. So they are taking measures, again, to try to bring that daily count down.
The pandemic-delayed Tokyo 2020 Olympics kicked off in Japan amid concerns about a rising number of infections in the city. The world's largest sporting event got underway with a softball game in Fukushima behind closed doors. The Tokyo Olympics, which will formally begin with Friday's opening ceremony, will be held largely without spectators to minimize the health risks. Japanese capital is already under a state of emergency following a surge in coronavirus cases, 79 of those among people accredited for the Games. The World Health Organization chief backed the event, saying it is a celebration of hope amid the pandemic. However, he said the pandemic could be ended if G20 economies showed collective leadership.
Instead of being deployed widely to quell the pandemic on all fronts, they have been concentrated in the hands and arms of the lucky few, deployed to protect the world's most privileged people, including those at lowest risk of the severe disease, while the most vulnerable remain unprotected. More than 3.5 billion vaccines.
The WHO chief said out of more than 3.5 billion globally administered vaccine doses, 75% have been in just 10 countries. He said in low-income countries, only 1% of people have received at least one dose, compared with more than half of people in high-income countries. Coronavirus pandemic has so far killed more than 4 million people around the world. Turkey dismisses as null and void the European Union's criticism of Ankara for deciding to reopen the abandoned Cypriot resort town of Varosha. Turkish Foreign Ministry said the bloc has no role to play in the dispute, accusing it of acting as an advocate for Greek Cypriot region. Ankara also noted that the latest remarks by Brussels show how much the EU is disconnected from reality. The reaction comes after the EU condemned Ankara's move to reopen Varosha as unacceptable, unilateral, and a breach of international law. The bloc's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, said the decision could raise tensions in Cyprus. The island of Cyprus has been split between the Greek Cypriot-run Republic of Cyprus and a self-declared Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus since 1974. The UK says it will permanently deploy two warships to disputed waters in the South China Sea amid growing tensions between Beijing and the West. During a joint announcement with his Japanese counterpart, British Defense Minister Ben Wallace said the deployment will take place later on this year. Wallace added that Britain will also sail a carrier strike group through the Chinese claimed waters in September. China and a number of other Asian countries, including Vietnam and the Philippines, lay overlapping claims on the strategic waterway. In the past months, tensions have flared between Beijing and the West over the issues. Investigative journalist Tony Gosling believes that the UK is deliberately pursuing a confrontational and provocative policy toward China.
The idea of projecting British power over to the South China Sea is very much like the Chinese sailing battleships, aircraft carriers up and down the River Thames. It's not really, the idea is not to be friendly to your foreign power. It's actually quite a provocative thing to do. The British, I think, are just simply part of the US strategy to have a confrontation with China. If anyone remembers about 3 years ago, John Pilger came out with a brilliant documentary, maybe 4 years ago actually, called The Coming War on China. And his prognosis, I think, was absolutely spot on. Brilliant journalist, hardly ever seen or heard in the Western press at all, even though he's one of the greatest journalists there's ever been. And The Coming War on China explains that the West, it looks like it's losing the economic war, and so it's going to go towards a much more provocative potential shooting war in order to try and intimidate China.
Twelve people have been killed and several others injured by record rainfall in China's central province of Henan. In the provincial capital, Zhengzhou, some 200,000 people were evacuated to safe zones. Weather forecasters say the torrential rains are the heaviest China has witnessed in 1,000 years. The deadly floods paralyzed Henan's transportation systems, affected dams, and upended the lives of millions of people. President Xi Jinping called the situation in Henan extremely severe and at a critical stage. He said flood prevention efforts there have been extremely difficult. Heavy rain started in Henan on Saturday and are expected to continue for the next 3 days. And that's it with international news.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate.
Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was not prepared to impose lockdown restrictions to stop the spread of COVID-19 to save the elderly, and denied the National Health Service would be overwhelmed, his former top advisor said in an interview aired on Monday, 19th of July. The article you're about to hear has been written by Reuters journalist Andrew McCaskill, Kanishka Singh and Richard Pullin. The piece is titled UK PM Johnson Dismissed COVID-19 Lockdown as Only Elderly Would Die, XAID says. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has not prepared to impose lockdown restrictions to stop the spread of COVID-19 to save the elderly, and denied that the National Health Service, the NHS, would be overwhelmed, his top advisor Dominic Cummings said in an interview aired on Monday, 19th of July. In his first television interview since leaving his job last year, excerpts of which were released on Monday, Dominic Cummings said Boris Johnson did not want to impose a second lockdown in the autumn last year because the people who are dying are essentially all over the age of 80. Cummings also claimed that Boris Johnson wanted to meet Queen Elizabeth a 95-year-old, despite signs that the virus was spreading in his office at the start of the pandemic, and when the public had been told to avoid all unnecessary contact, particularly with the elderly. The political advisor, who has accused the government of being responsible for thousands of avoidable COVID-19 deaths, shared a series of messages from October that are allegedly from Boris Johnson to aides. In one message, Dominic Cummings said Boris Johnson joked that the elderly could get COVID and live longer because most people dying were past the average age of life expectancy. Cummings alleges that Johnson messaged him to say, "And I no longer buy all this NHS overwhelm stuff. Folks, I think we may need to recalibrate." Reuters could not independently verify whether the messages were genuine. A spokesperson for Boris Johnson said the Prime Minister had taken the necessary action to protect lives and livelihoods, guided by the best scientific advice. The government he leads has delivered the fastest vaccination rollout in Europe, saved millions of jobs through the furlough scheme, and prevented the NHS from being overwhelmed through three national lockdowns. The government is entirely focused on emerging cautiously from the pandemic and building back better. Meanwhile, Britain's opposition Labour Party says the revelations by Dominic Cummings strengthened the case for a public inquiry and were further evidence that the Prime Minister has made the wrong calls time and again at the expense of public health. Dominic Cummings told the BBC that Boris Johnson told officials that he should never have agreed to the first lockdown and that he had to convince him not to take the risk of meeting the Queen. "I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm going to see the Queen. I said, what on earth are you talking about? Of course you can't go and see the Queen." Cummings claimed that he told Johnson, and he said he basically just hadn't thought it through. Despite questioning Johnson's fitness for the role as Prime Minister and castigating the government's fight against COVID-19, Dominic Cummings' criticism has yet to seriously puncture the British leader's ratings in opinion polls. The full interview will be broadcast on Tuesday, 20th of July. Meanwhile, Dominic Cummings has launched multiple attacks on his former boss, Boris Johnson, after leaving Downing Street in December, including at a seven-hour committee meeting with MPs and through a new subscription blog. The former chief advisor was subject to vociferous public criticism after it was revealed he had travelled to Durham with his family and later to Barnard Castle during the national lockdown. Cummings repeated his explanation that he had left London because of threats against his family, which he told MPs in May, but declined to say at a press conference he gave about the incident. "Everything that I said in the Rose Garden was true, but I didn't go into all of the security concerns in the background," he said. "The way we handled the whole thing was wrong on Monday. What I should have done is either just resigned and said nothing about anything, or I should have spoken to my family and said, listen, we're just going to have to come clean about the whole thing."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
weight of chains. Part 3.
In a few cases, however, the Hague Tribunal did manage to bring an indictment against Kosovo Albanians who were accused of committing crimes, like in the case of Ramush Haradinaj. Don't let the glasses fool you. Haradinaj was one ruthless KLA militant in the 1990s, accused of murdering Serbs, Roma, and even non-compliant Albanians during the Kosovo War.
We had a lot of difficulties to come to an end to the investigation against Haradinaj. But at the end, we achieved it. So we could issue an indictment against him, and this indictment was confirmed by a judge.
However, as the trial started and progressed, something strange happened.
Haradinaj was freed of all charge because a number of witnesses were killed. According to former Hague Tribunal prosecutor Khaled Ponte, 9 witnesses were killed between 2003 and 2007. So in such a situation, living witnesses are frightened and some of them refuse to testify, others change their testimony. The UN mission in Kosovo always refused to cooperate with the Hague Tribunal by refusing to send evidence of war crime.
It is understandable that NATO didn't want their KLA buddies in jail, but the largest single act of ethnic cleansing during the Yugoslav Wars, Operation Storm, in which Croat forces ethnically cleansed 250,000 Serbs from the Krajina region in Croatia, with thousands killed in cold blood, was perhaps the biggest test for the tribunal. General Ante Gotovina was in charge of that operation, and the Hague Tribunal put up an indictment. Gotovina was arrested and tried, and believe it or not, convicted.
First instance trial, he was convicted 23 years. So, evidences were there. Enough evidences to convict and to sentence him.
However, another strange thing happened here. The case quickly went to appeal, the previous sentence was overturned, and Gotovina was immediately released.
It was extremely damaging to Serbs in this case, you know, and killing in Operation Storm. They obliged the Serbs to leave Knin and so on and so on. So we prove it. In the first instance, the Gotovina was convicted. So why now on appeal this completely different decision?
You think it was more of a political decision?
You say it, and I must say yes, because I cannot believe it.
Ante Gotovina was given a hero's welcome in Croatia. But not all Croats believed in the Gotovina myth. This war profiteer, however, was a free man, with the blessing of the West. He played an important part in what the West really wanted. And when a nation has war profiteers as heroes, it's no wonder that as the fighting subsides, the system remains corrupt. Ivo Sanader ruled as Prime Minister of Croatia from 2003 to 2009, and under the mask of being a European Union-friendly statesman, bought people left and right. According to the Washington Times, Sanader turned Croatia into a gangster country, and by controlling most of the media, including state television and leading Croatian newspapers, he could make sure that the people only saw things his way. During his rule, Sanader amassed enormous wealth that included illegally acquired property, luxurious villas, and a lavish collection of watches worth over $200,000. After 6 years in power, Sanader decided to step down. Eventually, Sanader was arrested, put on trial, and sentenced to 10 years for his wrongdoings. However, the system remained corrupt, and the people of the former Yugoslavia could only hope that an honest, hard-working man would show up and fight against systemic corruption. He came in the form of a TV morning talk show guest. Ljubiša Milanović was appointed by former Serbian Health Minister Zoran Stanković to his anti-corruption division. He was the first state official to openly criticize the police, state prosecutors, and anti-corruption agency, claiming that they just weren't interested in helping him fight corruption. Yes, the cartoon never ended, but Milanović's position did. He quickly got sacked by Health Minister Stanković after these statements on state television. Fortunately, the Serbian political elite took these warnings seriously and decided to act decisively. That's what the people love to watch. They've been conditioned by the media to look the other way when it came to matters of urgency that could really affect their lives. Considering what the new guys after Milosevic did to the education system, it made some sense.
Former Yugoslavia had an excellent educational system. I'm product of that system, so most of the people from those years, my colleagues, are all over the world and they're extremely successful. However, what happened after 2001, they simply assumed that whatever was suggested by European Union, they have to implement it regardless of consequences.
In 2001, Yasmina Vujic, a professor at Berkeley University, the first woman to become dean of the Department of Nuclear Engineering in the United States, suggested to the then Minister of Education, Gasha Knežević, and his associate professor, Srbijan Katurajlić, that before they attempt any reforms, they should invite professors from the diaspora, who worked in all kinds of education systems, and form the best one for Serbia. There was no reply. The reforms went on as planned.
Bottom line is that students of today are learning 10% of what we learned in the previous system. So they are producing new generations of students that will be poorly educated, particularly in terms of higher education in my field, such as electrical engineering or mechanical engineering and so on.
Yes, the education system made no sense, and no one had the guts to fix it. After all, a good education system would lead to a smart populace. And which government in their right mind would want a free-thinking society that could critically analyze what that same government was doing? Things weren't any better for cultural workers or artists. Culture and art simply weren't on the radar for many people. The most interesting story I heard was when independent filmmaker Branko Radaković, who was making his documentary Culture is Blooming, asked a guy in the Serbian town of Paracin about his thoughts on culture.
Somebody was too honest in front of the camera.
The guy still wanted the clip removed. Branko refused. Since the government didn't waste time on irrelevant tasks such as creating a civilized populace, the media used their power to popularize shows that educated and enlightened the people on what really mattered.
You use the term democracy, its presence or its absence, strictly for politics.
The United States has a pretty good record, I think, over the centuries of helping move countries toward democracy.
In fact, the United States instituted regime change wherever democracy resulted in a leader who was not favorable to Western economic interests.
Any country or political movement that tries to use the land, the labor, the capital, the markets of that country in a way outside of this global imperial system will be designated as an enemy, as an aggressor, as an oppressor, as a danger to the American people, and therefore we have to attack them.
It was also important to make the American people afraid of the proclaimed enemy.
I was raised, my whole generation, it was the communists. Communists here, communists everywhere. Communists are going to get your mama, you know?
You are the target of those who would trample the liberties of free men. You are in the crosshairs of the bomb sight an enemy is centering on you.
Now the communists are gone, and that became a crisis for a while. They had to find another demon who is a threat and frightens the people enough, and now it's the terrorists.
Since the end of the Cold War in 1991, the end of communism, the United States has behaved very badly. It's a sole superpower. It has tried to dominate the world completely.
Your country has to be thrown open. It has to be a satellite for us. The empire sees two kinds of nations out there. One is satellites, or client states, they're called, and the other is potential enemy. Iraq is a very special, interesting case, because you saw both of those things happening with the very same leader, Saddam Hussein, when he was murdering everybody on the left, when he destroyed the Iraqi democracy. Washington loved him. They loved him. They sent him aid. They took pictures with him, and he was their poster boy. And then when he turned around and started insisting on a better deal on the oil quotas, he didn't go toward the free market, and he committed economic nationalism. Then they suddenly started saying, oh, Saddam Hussein, he's worse than Hitler.
It seemed very dangerous to support policies the U.S. didn't like, and it didn't matter whether you were a dictator or a Democrat. Hugo Chavez was democratically elected in Venezuela in 1998, promising to stand up to the United States. Many thought he wouldn't last long. His first task was to change the 1961 constitution that was drawn up by the neoliberal elites.
This constitution was making for them, for
their benefit, not for the benefit of the people. Who promised the people in 1998 in the campaign to do that? And in 1999, who make a new constitution? In our constitution, in the first article, we change our foreign policy. Our policy will be based in three important things: cooperation, complementation, and solidarity.
What this meant in practice was soon noticeable.
In 2001, when in Argentina was a very difficult economy situation, no, the first country and the only country helped Argentina was Venezuela, was Chavez. Cristina all the time said that. Chavez tell her, you have not dollars, you have coal, you have meat, and we have oil. We give you oil. You can pay oil with coal, with meat. It is not necessary to use dollars. No?
Wait, working together on exchanging products they produce? Not bickering amongst each other? Not importing U.S. products? Not using the dollar? Blasphemy.
He announced that Venezuela would pull out of both the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And his government took control of the last remaining privately run oil fields.
Chavez only practiced state socialism that used to be practiced in Yugoslavia. But for this, Chavez became an enemy of the United States.
Hugo Chavez is a dictator.
The world's worst dictators. Hugo Chavez.
A dictator.
A dictator.
Anti-democratic despot.
Tyrant with a radical agenda.
Crushing free people.
There is such a thing as a killer clown, and he may be it.
In 15 years, we have 19 elections. 19. And we only didn't win in one. We won 18 election, 18, and all the time say that Chavez is a dictator, and now they are saying that Maduro is dictator.
The media were playing an important role for what was being prepared for Chavez. It was 2002, and for the CIA, everything was going as planned.
In the end, this is what triggered the overthrow of Hugo Chavez. Armed gangs loyal to the Venezuelan president firing on thousands of anti-government protesters. After 16 people were killed and hundreds wounded, last night soldiers surrounded the presidential palace.
Even though it was never established who fired at both pro-Chavez and anti-Chavez demonstrators, Chavez was taken to prison. Another democratically elected leader was replaced by a dictator, Venezuelan Federation of Chambers of Commerce President Pedro Carmona, a pro-business elites leader who quickly dissolved the National Assembly and Supreme Court and declared the Constitution void. While the United States were cheering on the real dictator, Carmona, something unexpected happened. People started pouring into the streets. A pro-Chavez popular uprising was becoming unstoppable.
The power of the people in the street. We go to the street, and in front of us was the military. We are not afraid. We go on, no, and we ask that we want our president. We want our president back.
The pro-Chavez presidential guard took back the presidential palace and reinstalled Chavez as president. The coup d'etat failed. In spite of huge CIA support and almost all of the Venezuelan media also supporting the coup. When Chavez came to power, 80% of the country was classified as poor.
Now our poor people is less than 20%.
At the beginning of Chavez's rule, 45% were extremely poor.
So now very, very poor is 5.6%. It's the first time in the history of Venezuela that 65% of the money we get about the oil are using for increase the level of living of the people.
Perhaps Chavez had some good ideas, and his ideas spread throughout Latin America. A continent away, a country was feeling the shackles of debt, and many people simply didn't understand why it paralyzed the country.
The so-called sovereign foreign debt of Greece was created and accumulated by the policies of the governments, which were doing neoliberal policies, by the way, taking loans from the international markets, giving cheap loans to entrepreneurs and enterprises, which were then taking the money out to Switzerland or to the Cayman Islands and so on, without investing them, without creating growth, without creating giving jobs within the capitalist system.
What a fine system it was.
The debt have not been created by the peoples, neither in the case of Greece nor in the case of Portugal or Ireland.
But the people were the ones who were supposed to pay the price. This is why the people of many countries facing this problem went to the streets to demand justice. Many of these countries had already repaid their debts several times over, but because of the interest rates, they were condemned to a never-ending vicious cycle of debt payments. However, one president decided that when it came to his country paying off these debts, enough was enough.
Ecuador refused paying the debt after Rafael Correa came to power, who was second and third time re-elected, and he said, no, we have paid it already.
President Correa's the man. He declared his country's debt illegitimate and said that Ecuador would default on over $3 billion worth of bonds. He pledged to fight the creditors in international courts and actually succeeded, reducing the price of outstanding bonds by over 60%.
If the loans are given, this means to make profit, to make business actually through the poor countries which are in debt, then there is also legally by international law a basis to claim that you cannot pay back after 10 years paying. You have paid it already two times. For that, you need willing governments which will confront the powerful banks and the IMF and so on.
President Correa reduced Ecuador's poverty, indigence, and unemployment. And he could do this because he had the people behind him. But another reason why some countries were successful in rebelling against Western control is also because they had a strong military. Yugoslavia had the fourth largest military in Europe, and while it was united, no one dared to attack it militarily at the time. A source from Serbia's military security agency that asked to remain anonymous told me just how ready Serbia was to defend itself against an external enemy. This comes as no surprise. Boris Tadic, who was among the first to hold the post of Minister of Defense of Serbia and Montenegro after Milosevic fell, later becoming President of Serbia in two terms, prided himself on his achievements in regards to the military. Though they were called experts by the government, pushing Serbia's military towards so-called NATO standards was top priority. When someone starts shooting at you, your English proficiency and computer skills might not be enough to protect yourself. Military analyst Miroslav Lazanski explained on Serbian national television why the military was unable to adequately protect the country from wide-scale flooding that took place in 2014. As the people were becoming aware that Western-imposed reforms weren't in the interest of ordinary citizens, the West had to make sure that the people, their leaders, and the media would stay in line. To do this, the West continued funding certain non-governmental organizations.
It's very funny because a lot of these non-governmental organizations are governmental. They're financed by the United States government.
The NGOs that had the most political and media influence in Serbia were the Humanitarian Law Center, officially led by Sandra Orlović, who succeeded Nataša Kandić, the Center for Cultural Decontamination, led by Borka Pavićević, the Helsinki Board for Human Rights, led by Sonja Biserko, the Youth Initiative for Human Rights, led by Maja Micić, and the Center for Euro-Atlantic Studies, led by Jelena Milić. Most of these NGOs operated in other republics of the former Yugoslavia as well, but the Serbian representatives were the most interesting.
Serbian public, they immediately discard us and discharge us as paid by NATO.
But where does the center receive its funding?
From Open Society Fund in Belgrade, from National Endowment for Democracy, from Rockefeller Brother Foundation.
National Endowment for Democracy, Rockefeller Brothers.
For two events from NATO Public Diplomacy, but it was not enough.
So you are paid by NATO in a way.
For two events.
From the beginning when we were formed, it was support from Swedish Helsinki Committee and it's Fund for Open Society, and it is a solid foundation.
And some governments like Norway, which is very present in the region, not only helping NGOs but also state.
The Norwegian People Aid built us a roof because it was ruined here where we are. Look at this, it looks like that.
And then through different humanitarian programs and so on.
What Ms. Kandić didn't want to say is that her Humanitarian Law Center was directly funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, the Open Society Foundation, USAID, the United States Institute of Peace, the Balkan Trust for Democracy, Civil Rights Defenders, the King Bodding Foundation, and then there's also the European Commission, the OSCE Mission to Serbia, the British Embassy in Belgrade, the Austrian Development Cooperation, the Canadian Embassy in Belgrade, the German Embassy in Belgrade, the Royal Netherlands Embassy in Belgrade, the Swiss Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and 10 other foreign organizations. At the end of the day, whose interests is Ms. Kandic looking after? The citizens of Serbia, who largely dislike her work, or all these foreign governments and organizations, which give her money? But the foreign financiers don't stop with the NGOs that I mentioned. Some also fund UKOM Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, Women in Black, Peshtanik or Hourglass, Sanja Committee for the Protection of Human Rights and Freedoms, Civic Initiatives, and many others. Don't let the whole human rights mantra fool you. This is especially interesting considering that Borka Pavicevic's Center for Cultural Decontamination received $38,000 in 2013 from the National Endowment for Democracy to promote public debate on various issues.
Does everybody have the right to a different opinion?
Some NGO members were also members of political parties at the same time, like Dušan Gamser, who was an economic advisor at the Center for Euro-Atlantic Studies, as well as the international secretary of the Liberal Democratic Party.
So you're a member of a political party and you work at an NGO?
Yes, yes, why not?
You don't think there's a conflict of interest?
No, I don't.
Why not?
Yeah, these are different... things in political party, you are helping your party colleagues to get to power. You are advising them. You do things, various things in the party, and when you are in the NGO, you do things, maybe same things by other methods.
Heartiest Ada Gorban felicitations. In the name of God, the all-compassionate, the all-merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and heartiest congratulations to you all on the auspicious day of Eid al-Adha, or the Eid al-Qurban, that is the Feast of Sacrifice. It is a day of great blessing, and we pray to God Almighty to shower His mercy upon all believers. Stay with us for a special feature in this regard. The 10th of Dhul-Hijjah is the day of remembrance of the Prophet Abraham's firm and unflinching faith in God and how he obeyed the divine commandment to offer his firstborn son Ishmael as sacrifice. It is the day on which the all-merciful Lord accepted Abraham's sincere offer by replacing his son at the last moment with a ram sent from heaven so that Ishmael will live, marry, produce children, and be the ancestor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. God says in Ayah 107 of Surah Safat, "And we ransomed him with the great sacrifice." the words of God in deferring the sacrifice of Ishmael and ransoming it with the great sacrifice, or Vephenazim, as the Noble Quran says, is a reference to the martyrdom of the Prophet of Islam's grandson, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, along with his sons, brothers, nephews, and companions, in the full limelight of history, in order to save Islam and humanitarian values. The 10th of Dhul-Hajjah thus marks the climax of the Hajj rituals on the plain of Mina, near Mecca, witnesses where the pilgrims stone the symbolic devil to demonstrate their determination against all forms of temptations and tyranny, and then offer sheep, cattle, or camel as sacrifice. This is indeed the pinnacle of monotheism. No wonder Ayah 79 of Surah An'am has preserved Prophet Abraham's remarkable words, "Indeed, I have turned my face toward him who originated the heavens and the earth as a Hanif, and I am not one of the polytheists." In Islamic culture, Eid has a specific meaning. It means happiness or state of joy on the successful performance of duties. A Muslim is a person who is committed to the responsibilities entrusted by God. For this reason, whenever our work is sincerely and solely for the sake of God and is pleasing in the sight of God, as well as pleasing to ourselves, it is the day of Eid. Thus, the Hajj pilgrims who are still encamped on the plain of Mina to observe the rest of the rituals have the opportunity to express their sincere wishes to God, and hopefully these will be accepted. The Prophet's sixth infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, says Mina was so named because Archangel Gabriel asked Prophet Abraham to express his wish. It is the place where the temptations of the Satan came to naught on three occasions, and he tried to make Ishmael disobey Abraham regarding the divine commandment of sacrifice, when he attempted to mislead Hajar against her husband Abraham's intention, and when he failed to dissuade Abraham from carrying out God's commandment. Hence, the three columns in Mina indicating the places where Satan approached the three blessed persons are stoned to this day, as part of the obligatory Hajj ritual by pilgrims to drive away the internal and external Satans. The meat of the animals sacrificed in Mina is donated to the poor so that, in this way, they get close to God Almighty. In Ayah 37 of Surah Hajj, God says, "It is not their flesh or their blood that reaches Allah. Rather, it is your God-weariness that reaches Him." This ayah means to say that neither the flesh nor the blood of your sacrifices reaches God, but it is your piety and sincerity which is important to Allah. Iran's contemporary Islamic thinker, Ayatollah Muhammad Reishahri, says, "Piety has certain degrees, and sacrifice is the highest point of piety. The first degree is to avoid wrongdoing. The still higher degree is to avoid evil acts, including sins. And the highest degree is to sacrifice in the way of God, whatever one possesses. In other words, when we are ready to give up all things and persons dear and near ones to us and devote ourselves wholly to God, then we have reached the absolute state of the ultimate beloved and besought of all, that is, God Almighty, like Prophet Abraham practically demonstrated to us. The rituals of Eid al-Adha have historical roots going back in antiquity to Prophet Abraham. He was wholly resigned to the will of God in all affairs. The Noble Quran well presents glimpses of his selfless servitude to God as well as that of his firstborn son Ishmael. Abraham and his wife Sarah had grown old and failed to produce any child. Abraham prayed to God for an heir to succeed. The prayer was answered when his wife offered to him as the second spouse, the Egyptian maid, Hajar, who conceived and Ishmael was born. A few years later, God granted another son to Abraham, and this time through his wife Sarah, who was old and well beyond childbearing age. Thus, after the miraculous birth of Isaac, Sarah became jealous of Hajar and Ishmael and told Abraham to remove them from her sight. On God's command, Abraham took Hajar and Ishmael to the remote Arabian desert in the then obscure place called Mecca and left them there. In this waterless